Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the December 4th, 2011 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard, the podcast devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, Objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and here are the topics I have planned for us this evening. First, the Senate passes almost unanimously Senate Bill 1867, which authorizes military appropriations for 2012. The bill contains sections which some, including Ron Paul, Rand Paul, Judge Napolitano on Fox, and others, have alleged that allows the president to deem you a terrorist and either detain you indefinitely or, worse, ship you off to a foreign country. Are they right about this? Second, I have a quote-unquote interview with our own Bosch Boston, who had a piece on Front Page Magazine this week, and it was called Non-Muslim Muslims and the Jihad Against the West. We'll ask him about that piece. Then we'll discuss a bomb that was buried in the Obamacare legislation that went off this week, and a contributor at Forbes.com wrote, of all things about it, hallelujah, you will barf as I did. Then we'll discuss the Federal Trade Commission's settlement with Facebook. Some people, including Mark Zuckerberg himself, seem happy about it, but I'm not, and I don't think you will be after you hear what I have to say about it. And we've got a couple more things if there's time. Before we dive in here, there's some logistics. There's a couple of ways for those of you who are attending live to interact with us. First is the phone number. It's 760-888-5817, and we encourage your calls. Again, that's 760-888-5817. And the second way is the chat room. I see a bunch of people are there in the chat room. Go ahead and type questions and comments there as well. So let's warm up with a little bit of legislative analysis. No, it's not going to be too heavy. Don't worry about it. Yeah, Bosch is already snoring. There were some people basically saying that the American way of life and freedom is gone this week due to the passage on December 1st of Senate Bill 1867, 1867. And again, this authorizes the appropriations for the Department of Defense, essentially, for 2012. And it's got tons of sections. And then buried within it are a few sections. It's called Subtitle D, and it has to do with detainee matters. And, again, you may have seen some clips going around the web. Go ahead and let me know there in the chat room if you've seen some of these. But Rand Paul spoke on the floor of the Senate about it, saying that basically if you had a few fingers lost and you stockpiled some supplies and maybe you owned guns, then you could be deemed a terrorist by the president, and then you could be detained indefinitely, or maybe you could be shipped off, and this would be horrible. It's a violation of our constitutional rights, and these sections of the legislation should be struck. And basically, Judge Napolitano agreed. He did a whole section on it on his show on Fox News. And then it was interesting because he had, I think, a military guest, and he deferred to Napolitano about the legislation itself. Napolitano didn't read from the legislation, so of course, what do? If you want to get to the bottom of something like this and see if it's as bad as they say it is, you actually go and get the legislation, and you can find these things easily on the web now. Then the problem is wading through it. Luckily, there was a table of contents at the beginning, so then I was able to get to page 426 of the legislation quite easily. It's section 1031 through approximately 1036. 1037 has to do with pleading guilty to a capital offense. It's not really relevant to what we're talking about. So let me just give you a brief overview of the sections, what they do, and then we'll talk about some of the specifics. In general, I want to calm everybody down and say I don't think that there's that much that is bad here. Like any legislation or rulemaking where there's some discretion in applying it, yeah, some people might abuse it. But the language in here in terms of who can be detained, who can be carted off to Guantanamo or shipped overseas, it seems very clear, and it doesn't seem to include just you and me, people who might disagree with something about the government. I don't think the president's going to be able to use it to go after his political enemies, is what I'm saying here. So Section 1031, which is the first section in this subtitle D, talks about detaining or doing other things consistent with the law of war with respect to what are called covered persons. And it's that definition of covered persons that's very key and that really hasn't been talked about by a lot of the fearmongers. Then there's Section 1032, which lays out a requirement of military detention for certain persons who are caught in the act. They are actually belligerent enemies caught in the act of doing something against the United States. Then Section 1033 discusses a certification procedure that is required to transfer prisoners out of Guantanamo Bay, to ship them out. There's some provisions in there that might give you some pause, but it's not the type of thing that's going to make you worry about the government coming after you and shipping you out. It's maybe going to make you wonder whether they're shipping overseas some people from Guantanamo Bay that they should be keeping here instead. That's the kind of worry that I get from it. Section 1034 says that you, I mean, this is, you know, in essence, right? I have to summarize this garbage. It says that you can't transfer from Guantanamo to places in the United States without the authorization of Congress. You know, sometimes the president doesn't want to detain or try people in Guantanamo. He'd rather put them in New York or elsewhere. And this is this 1034 essentially prohibits them from spending money out of this appropriation to do that. Then 1035 talks about a periodic detention review process. So if they're detaining people, they want to do a periodic review as to whether the continued detention of those people is necessary for national security. And then 1036 talks about the status determination procedures. And I don't see it explicitly mentioning the words covered persons, but anyone who is being detained or whose status is being determined as whether they should be detained, I think would be covered by 1036, and we'll talk about a little bit with that. So that just gives you an overview of the kind of provisions. Under 1031, it says that all they're doing is affirming the authority of the president to use necessary and appropriate force pursuant to the law that we're all very familiar with, the law that was passed just days after 9/11. It's called the Authorization for Use of Military Force, Public Law 107-40. So it's 107-40. And of course, this should have been a declaration of war. It wasn't. This is what we have instead, serving as our declaration of war. And it includes the authority for the armed forces of the United States to detain so-called covered persons who are defined in this subsection B. So here are the covered persons who can be detained. So you see if you're in danger of falling under this description, and then see if you're worried, okay? B1 says, a person who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th, 2001, or harbored those responsible for those attacks. Okay, so anybody here fall under that category? Nope, I don't think so. Not you, right? No, I don't think so. So I'm not in danger there. Then the second is a person who was a part of or substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners, including any person who has committed a belligerent act or has directly supported such hostilities in aid of such enemy forces.
Leftist media.
Did you guys hear Bosch?
The leftist media, maybe? I mean, in some ways?
Anyway, it says directly supported such hostilities.
Okay.
So
they're indirectly
supported. There is perhaps comfort, but we're talking about direct aid here, could get you defined as a covered person. Okay, so those are the two categories of people. You either directly were involved in September 11th, or you substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or you directly supported hostilities against United States or its coalition partners. So if you're one of those people, yeah, you should be worried. Then it says that you can be disposed of under the law of war. You could be detained. You could have a military trial, perhaps, under the law of war. You might be transferred to... You could be transferred to an alternative court or competent tribunal. Actually, it doesn't say anything about killing people in this one. You could be transferred to the custody or control of the person's country of origin or any other foreign country or any other foreign entity. So this is probably where someone like Rand Paul was worried. You know, we could just be deemed a terrorist and then get transferred out. What I don't see anywhere in this legislation is under the definition of covered person that it said that simply for stockpiling supplies, like he said, over 7 days worth of food, or that if you had had a few fingers cut off, I guess, which would show that you were involved in combat. Of course, I happen to know carpenters. I happen to know carpenters who have lost a finger here or there in construction accidents. I mean, are they to be deemed military suspects or terrorist suspects? That's crazy. If you have guns, I mean, no, I don't see that anywhere in here. To be a covered person who is subject to this detention or deportation that they're describing under these sections, you have really got to be involved in our enemies from the terrorist attacks.
They mean covered like burqa? I mean, they mean like covered...
I don't know.
Turbans?
I don't know. Now, the puzzling thing about this, and I do refer you in general if you want to read something way more detailed than we're going to talk about here, Andrew C. McCarthy, who writes at a column called The Corner. I think it's just a subsection of the National Review website.
That's a blog. The National Review's blog.
And there's several several contributors,
Mark
right? Okay. So he writes for The Corner at National Review Online.
Shorter posts, and sometimes he writes for the longer pieces
National
Review.
Okay. Online. Oh, so it could be that he had a little piece in The Corner and then referred people to a longer piece in National Review Online about this particular issue. But he says, in effect, that this legislation doesn't even really do very much to expand powers that already existed under that law that I mentioned, the authorization for use of military force that was passed on September 18th, 2001.
I mean, we always have to be suspicious about Obama, always.
No,
but
I know.
If this is what we know of it to be, we have to take it, you know.
Well, and here's the thing. Some of what I see here, I see as imposing some limitations or restating limitations on that power,
right.
Limitations that already existed but perhaps weren't being followed
right.
as well as they should be. So, for instance, in Section D here of 1031, it says, nothing in this section is intended to limit or expand the authority of the president or the scope of the authorization for the use of military force. So you figure, well, why write it? It might be stating it in a different, more clear way.
Maybe.
It might just be reiterating it to make sure that with respect to the funds that are being dispersed for 2012, that none of them are being spent on the bad stuff.
It happens to be that the three of them are libertarians. And in a lot of ways, they're fundamentally anti-government. So they'll be suspicious of anything, even if it's a decent, protections for us and whatnot. I mean, Ron Paul, Napolitano.
Right.
They go off the deep end when it comes to foreign policy.
Well, and you know, they like to apply constitutional rights to even enemy combatants.
Right.
So that's part of the concern.
They're
now,
anti-government
in
the worst way.
Yeah. If people are concerned that the Constitution is violated by this, under subsection E of section 1031, it says nothing in this section is going to be construed to affect existing law or authorities. Right? So basically, there's nothing going to affect your constitutional rights under the Constitution. Obama says he's going to veto this bill, says David here in the chat room. So even though they've passed it and everyone's all worried if Obama's going to veto it anyway, now who knows why Obama's going to veto it? Why? Because it doesn't give him enough power to figure out what to do with these Guantanamo detainees? Because that's really where I see the interesting part of this is it relates to what to do with the detainees there. It says, in effect, like I said, in that section 1034, that they're not allowed to use funds to transfer those detainees to places within the United States. And maybe he doesn't like that. There could be other things he doesn't like it in this bill. It's a huge defense appropriation bill, and I'm sure there's all kinds of things that he doesn't like. There is subsection F of 1031, the requirement that the Secretary of Defense regularly brief Congress about determining who's a covered person, et cetera. You would like to see a short regular time interval specified in that section, not just regular. I mean, it could be regularly every year, you know, and then you could be sitting there for a year and they think that you're somebody in Al-Qaeda. This is not so good. But in any event, I do think that language under the covered person section is fairly clear. Then, like I said, section 1032 discusses a requirement for military custody. So some people are required to be put in military custody, and these are per subsection A1. Yeah, A1. It says that these are people who are captured in the course of hostilities. Captured in the course of hostilities that are authorized under the authorization for the use of military force. So basically, if you capture somebody in the course of hostilities, you're required to put them in military detention. The exception is if you've got someone who is a citizen of the United States or a legal resident of the United States, then maybe you can have an exception. There is also an ability of the Secretary of Defense to waive the requirement of this military detention for national security purposes. That might give you pause. You might want to see these people in military detention no matter what. So that might be of concern to you. But here it just says, yeah, if you are caught, if you are one of these covered persons and you're caught in the course of these hostilities, then it's a requirement of military detention unless you are a citizen or a resident alien. Oh, okay. Someone here in the chat room is giving us... Deborah. Oh, it's Deborah. Yeah. She's giving us a little bit of behind the scenes about why Obama might be upset with this bill. She says, Senator Kelly Ayotte. Added an amendment that essentially nullifies Obama's limitations on enhanced interrogation. That might be why he hates it. Yeah, it could be. And it could be one of many reasons that he hates it. Because, again, there are certain procedures that are being restated here as well. Now, in terms of procedures for implementing certain sections, so, for example, when they're going to have this military detention, there's a whole bunch of provisions that say, well, even though military detention is required, we want it to be conducted in such a way that we don't hinder the gathering of intelligence. So there's a whole bunch of pages about that I'm not going to bore you with. But you could see that you need to still be able to gather intelligence even if you're required to detain them militarily. So you would try to accommodate that need. Then section 1033, as I said, it lays out requirements for certain certifications that must be done before you can transfer any of the detainees at Guantanamo to either foreign countries or other foreign entities. Now, maybe foreign entities would be Palestine?
Quote, unquote, Palestine.
Yeah. Because that's not a country. I'm trying to figure out what foreign entity that isn't a foreign country you would be transferring to, and the only one I could come up with is the so-called Palestinians. But here it says that Secretary of Defense cannot use any of the authorized amounts. Again, this is an appropriations bill, so it's all tied to appropriations amounts. He can't use any of that money to transfer any of the detainees into either the custody or control of the individual's country of origin, any other foreign country, or any other foreign entity unless he submits to Congress the certification described in subsection B. And all the certification has to do with is trying to ensure that this person is not going to go and join up with Al-Qaeda again, that the foreign government or entity is stable enough to actually keep him incarcerated, keep him away from the bad guys, all kinds of stuff like that that I won't bore you with. It just wants to make sure that we can transfer the people out without them immediately going right back. Now, there is, in subsection C, a prohibition if there was a case of prior confirmed recidivism. If somebody, and I guess this has happened, they've let somebody out of Guantanamo.
Absolutely. And they're on the battlefield.
Yeah.
Iraq. They go back and they kill Americans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then they capture them again. So this is,
and the rate is so high because in their mind, like, they now they have further reason to kill us because they were incarcerated by us. You know, everything's a pretense.
It's our fault, of course, that we caught them and incarcerated them. So, you know, we should feel guilty. But in any event, here you know this section says that you should not transfer these people out again. Okay, you should. What was the fool me once and Bush couldn't get it,
no,
right?
That's pretty funny.
Fool me once, shame on you.
And then fool me twice,
shame on me. Or I don't know. I don't even know the one either. But he had it was his saying, so he should have remembered it.
And he was president.
And he was president, and he was in the middle of a big speech, and here we are. So, in terms of, there is an exception, though, and that kind of bothers me, that you could even have an exception in the cases of recidivism. So, as I said, it's really, and then there's a subsection D that it has a national security waiver. You can waive certification requirements basically when the government wants to. You just, you know, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense has to assure the Congress that alternative actions can be taken to address the underlying purpose of the certification requirements. So, you know, it says, don't transfer them out unless you certify that it's going to be okay, unless we decide we don't want to. And that's, to me, the more disturbing piece of information about this legislation. It's not that I feel like I'm in danger of being swooped up. I feel more in danger that it's a little too easy to transfer out these prisoners from Guantanamo.
Right.
So then there's reports that are being sent. So if the secretary does make a determination that he wants to get some waiver and exception from the certification requirement, then he at least needs to give Congress 30 days before he transfers the individual out so that they can object to the waiver and say, no, no way, you need a certification. So at least there's that. And basically, I think that's all we need to know about that section. So then, as I said, section 1034 talks about a prohibition on the use of funds to construct or modify facilities in the United States to house detainees transferred from Guantanamo. So it says no amounts from the 2012 appropriations for defense can be used for that purpose unless it's authorized by Congress. And good luck getting Congress to authorize that. At least they've been pretty good.
They haven't even declared war, you know. They have not even declared war.
No, I know. All they've got is that authorization for force. Section 1035 talks about procedures for periodic detention review of individuals. They have a periodic review process. And the purpose of the review is, explicitly it says, not to determine the legality of any detainee's law of war detention, but it's whether the detainee is a continuing threat, so whether you should release him. So they don't put everything up for grabs in this review. They're clarifying in this legislation, it says, that the Secretary of Defense is responsible for any final decision to release or transfer, but the Secretary of Defense has to consider the recommendation of a periodic review board or review committee that is established pursuant to some executive order that they had around the time of that original authorization. I think basically that Congress feels like it's been out of the loop in terms of these periodic reviews, and they just want to reiterate, yeah, okay, you have final say, but you're supposed to consider the recommendation. And then they list the factors that they're supposed to take into account in giving the recommendation to the Secretary of Defense during this periodic review procedure. Things like the likelihood the detainee will resume terrorist activity if transferred or released. You know, I'm quoting here from the legislation, the likelihood that the detainee will reestablish ties with Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities, the likelihood of family, tribal, or government rehabilitation or support for the detainee. Oh, yeah, they'll get rehabilitated. Woohoo. The likelihood the detainee may be subject to trial by military commission and any law enforcement interest in the detainee. So they're basically saying we're reiterating these procedures. These already exist. Yes, you have final approval, but you're supposed to listen to this committee of Congress. And the committee is made up of members of the Committee of Armed Services, Select Committee on Intelligence of the Senate, the Committee on Armed Services, and the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence of the House. So they're supposed to get a bunch of people from Congress from those to make up this review board. And then finally, Section 1036, Procedures for Status Determinations. And it says, not later than 90 days after the date of the enactment, the Secretary of Defense has to submit to the committees of Congress a report that sets forth the procedures for determining the status of persons detained pursuant to this authorization. And then the procedures say that if you have an unprivileged enemy belligerent, okay, so we're talking an alien who is fighting us, even that person is going to have a military judge presiding at the proceedings and may, if he wants, be represented by military counsel. It doesn't mention people other than unprivileged enemy belligerents because presumably those people have privileges, right? Like the right to counsel, all right, sorts of other things. So here it's saying that even unprivileged enemy belligerents have some procedural rights with respect to status determinations, and yet we're told by Rand Paul, by Judge Napolitano, that these sections that I just summarized for you, again, you can go look them up for yourself. If you Google, just type in the word Senate Bill 1867, you'll end up finding an official PDF that's released by the government. And it's easy to read. Like I said, it's pages 426 roughly to 444 of the legislation, and you can take a look for yourself. But I don't see that you and I are in danger of being hauled off here more than anything else. And frankly, I find more danger from the FTC Facebook settlement that I'm going to discuss in the next hour. So we're gonna talk about that in the next hour, and then I can horrify you with that instead. Do we have any questions or comments here on this? We already talked about Obama promising to veto this thing anyway, which could make the whole thing a moot point. I don't know if he hates it for the same reason that someone like Napolitano and Paul does. I doubt that.
No, they're
you know, it's sad because I did like what Rand Paul had to say about the Patriot Act, but now I'm wondering whether I need to go and read the specifics there.
He says things in a little more palatable way than Rand Paul or than Napolitano says. He does. He comes off a little more reasonable.
Yeah.
So, but he might be in the same camp. You know, I mean, his father is Rand Paul.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's, you know, the what do you call falls far from a tree, that line, but in a lot of ways he is.
Now, some people in the chat room are talking about various methods of rehabilitation.
So someone asked about the music. What's the opening music?
Oh, the opening music, people want to know. So that is a trimmed, very small segment of Like Spinning Plates, which is a tune by Radiohead, but it's a live version because the
studio version
is really strange. And
the studio version is like the bizarre version, and the actual live version is like the Superman.
Yeah.
It's really good.
You can go ahead and find that on iTunes. You can buy it.
Yeah, they're talking about the fact that you can't rehabilitate, and you can't.
Yeah.
I mean, you can kill them. That's how you rehabilitate them. I mean, you put them in the ground.
Well, this is Michael says they're talking about rehabilitating pedophiles in various ways having to do with physical alterations that I will not articulate right here.
Actually, I think Maya says that basically rehabilitating them is as logical as trying to rehabilitate pedophiles. It's possible.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And it is. I mean, these guys they're all in. Once they've crossed that line, they can't go back. I mean, this is true. I mean, once terrorists, I think always terrorists, especially if you committed, you know, murder.
Yeah, Tom says, you guys really like Radiohead. I never really got them beyond their major hits. We will throw you out a few recommendations, Tom, and then
stuff.
You can see. Because there are some...
I mean, beautiful stuff.
Beyond some of the big hits, there are some that I like. Although I think I stick mostly to the hits more in my taste.
I like some
maybe
of the
there are some unquote, of the hits that you're not familiar with.
Yeah. I like some of the quote-unquote weird ones, as you call it.
Yeah. So No questions or comments? Did everybody here already think that there was no big deal about this Senate bill before I told you about it? Was not even kind of preaching to the choir, so to speak? I do recommend Andrew McCarthy's more detailed analysis if you have any questions.
No, but it was good because people did express big-time fear over it, as in it's over. We're done. And we're not done yet.
Yeah, I mean, I had a Facebook friend who said, mourning, you know, the American freedom and way of life, and as far as I know, also from the experts who are familiar with that authorization of force bill from September 2001, that this doesn't expand the power in any significant way. It merely articulates specifics of it and perhaps reiterates it for people who haven't been listening, I guess, within the government.
And, if Ron Paul was rational in terms of foreign policy, we could consider what he's saying a little more also. Maybe he might have a better point, but he's Ron Paul.
Right, right. And how much of it is him being concerned about the so-called civil rights of the enemy?
Well, he never says anything about the enemy, ever. Ever.
Yeah.
We created them. We're like, they're our Frankenstein monster, according to Ron Paul.
So, okay, getting to the enemy. Let's go ahead and discuss a bit about your article. So you had an article on Front Page Magazine this week, and it made quite a few waves, called Non-Muslim Muslims and the Jihad Against the West.
Yep.
And just tell us a little bit about the article and how it came about, first of all.
Well, you know, for years I've been arguing that we should call Islam by its name, Islam. And lately there's been a debate between Andrew C. McCarthy and Robert Spencer.
Again, Andrew McCarthy, who I just referred you to. So remember, we like Andrew McCarthy.
Oh, yeah, he's very good. And he was great on this issue. He's called it by its name. And over the years, I think he's considered the non-Muslim Muslims like Zuhd Jasser a little too much. I mean, Zuhd Jasser doesn't represent anything but besides Zuhd Jasser. I said this in a talk. I said his Islam might as well be called Zuhd Jasserism. It's an individual subjective view of Islam. But anyway, so Andrew C. McCarthy, Robert and Robert Spencer and David Horowitz had written a piece about Islamophobia, and National Review titled it Islamism. And I know Robert wouldn't use that term. It was National Review changing the title because they're uncomfortable with the idea of calling Islam Islam.
And giving background, what does it mean for somebody to use Islamism versus Islam?
Well, the whole point is to not say Islam, to not condemn the religion.
Right.
You know, because that's, we have to respect religion, right?
So you've got Robert Spencer and David Horowitz together wrote an article.
Right.
National Review Online published it and used in the title the word Islamism.
Yeah, which was not the word that they chose.
Right, right. And it's common knowledge. Everybody, if you don't know, if you write for blogs or newspapers,
sometimes they change title.
They almost always like to change your title. It is very, very common that you're going to have your title changed if you're writing for somebody else's publication. So just know it now. You might have a title that you love, but be prepared to see it change. So this is what happens to them. But nonetheless, Andrew McCarthy, he looks at
He jumped the gun because he looked at the article and he assumed wrongly that Robert had used it. So maybe Robert had come around. So
Robert had taken on Islamism as his term to use to refer to the enemy's ideology.
Robert,
right?
This is
what Andrew McCarthy is
assuming. Then he basically he cited that in an article that he wrote about the terminology, and Robert countered that and said, you know, that wasn't the case. So he made the case, and then Robert was given the opportunity to respond to Andrew in a piece called "The Truth About Islam" in National Review, which I'm shocked that they actually published as the truth about Islam as such, which is great. So I was asked what I thought about it by someone, and I said, you know what, let me write something up, because I every so often, and the last time I got in on this, I wrote a piece called Calling Islam Islam. It was a pretty good piece, but I feel like I've had a little more to say now. It's at least 2 years old, that piece, I believe. So then from that, we were in Florida at Restoration Weekend, David Horowitz's. And a few hours before this panel between a debate between Robert and Andrew, I was asked to be on after Warren Baroness Carolyn Cox was asked to be on. And that was great. Some of you may have seen the video. Check it out. If you haven't, it's basically the thing was Islam versus Islamism, but they changed the
now,
title.
Now, if they want to see your panel appearance there,
it's
they go
blog.
To your blog at faustin.blogspot.com.
Yep. Right.
So it's F-A-W-S-T-I-N,
yep.
faustin.blogspot.com
right.
for the panel. So you participate in the panel, and
yep.
that got more of your thinking. Yep. Yeah.
So then I came back after the thing and put this thing together. It took a little while, but I wanted to get it right. And they published it at the front page of the magazine the other day, I think Friday. And, you know, the most popular piece there, and the most common.
So what do
most,
you do in the piece, essentially?
Well, basically, I break down the point that there are, you know, that the consistent practitioners of Islam and Islam is the enemy. That's the problem. And it's not non-Muslim Muslims, because the fact is we have to recognize the reality that there are some Muslims who are not at war with us. By the nature that they haven't submitted to Islam.
Most of them.
I mean, yeah. My whole family. I mean, they're not jihadists. They some of them eat pork. Some of them drink. They eat. They have dogs. I mean, they're. But again, the problem is that they give Islam a good face, and that is the main problem. And they never say anything against jihad. So in a sense, they're part of the evil. You know, they're apologists for evil in that sense. And it's sickening. But you know, they're not at war with us. So we're not at war with them. You know, it is what it is. But I also refer to it as a problem for us because, you know, we're playing this game. It's Muslim roulette. We don't know the jihadists until they blow themselves up. Because sometimes, you know, they have no records. They have nothing until they kill people. All of a sudden, they go from being, quote-unquote, Muslims to jihadists. And if I could read just a few excerpts from it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do recommend reading the whole thing. This is just a little gist. I open with, my name is Bosh and I'm a recovering Muslim. You know, and then I said, the only reason we're talking about Islam is because it doesn't mean peace. That's the only reason. The only reason we're talking about Islam is 9/11. And yet there are Muslims who don't mean us harm, meaning there are Muslims who have not submitted to Islam's call for violence against us. You know, I added this right now just to connect it because I just put some excerpts. There are self-titled Muslims who don't practice Islam. That's good for them and good for us, but there are those among us who think they're practicing some sort of enlightened Islam, and that's not the case. They may identify themselves as Muslim, but they can't be identified as Muslims according to Islam. And the main problem I have with these is essentially non-Muslim Muslims, especially in the middle of this war being waged on us by their more consistent coalitionists, is that they give the enemy cover. They force us to play a game of Muslim roulette since we can't tell which Muslim is going to blow himself up until he does. I'm sorry for repeating myself. But
mm-hmm.
And their indifference about the evil being committed in the name of the religion is a big reason why the reputation is where it is, essentially in the toilet. Non-observant Muslims are not our problem, you know, but neither are they the solution to our problem, as some think. Our problem is Islam, its most consistent practitioners. There is nothing in Islam that stays the hands of Muslims who want to kill non-Muslims. Nothing. I often say that your average Muslim is morally superior to Muhammad, to their own religion. And, you know, so it's no accident that Western analysts of Islam, who are most informed about Islam, are also most critical of it. And while those least informed are least critical. You might go on for a little more. I got
yeah,
a few more.
Let's see what else that you have.
And then, you know, those calling for a change within Islam, you know, the Westerners among us during this war would be surprised at how much Islam can be changed through an honest war on our behalf. You can't make a violent religion like Islam nonviolent by argument, only by greater retaliatory force against state sponsors of jihad terrorism.
So your idea is that people need to recognize that Islam itself is the problem,
yep.
But at the same time, you are not saying that the solution is to be at war with all people who describe themselves as Muslims.
No, and then think about that, you know, because in my talk, someone says, so are you saying we got to kill a billion? I said, no, we don't have to kill 1.3 billion people. We have to go after the state sponsors of terrorism devastatingly. I mean, bomb them to smithereens to the point where, you know, engaging in jihad is the worst thing they could possibly do.
Right. They see that jihad doesn't pay off.
They see,
what
okay,
the
jihad
consequences it are.
Means our destruction. So we will end jihad. That's what they have to do, like Germany, like Japan. And, you know, and then this, you know, this thing about Islamophobia. Let me just mention this. You know, our problem is not Islamophobia, quote unquote. I always put it in quotes. It's Islamophilia. Is this uncritical, uninformed, absolute defense of Islam by Western elites after 9/11 that I refer to as Islamgate. It's a scandal for the ages that few involved would ever admit to being part of. And, you know, then, I mean, in essence, basically, we've tried everything since 9/11 except real war. War is the answer to jihad. That's it.
Right. And you also point out the fact that altruism and the fact that we are concerned in an altruistic way for the future of Muslims and Islam has been part of the problem, maybe. I got the impression at the panel that you had people who were Christian who said, well, look, I have a really nice experience living life as a religious person under Christianity. I really want to help protect that for the people who call themselves Muslims. I don't want them to feel bad about
they
living
don't
under
understand
their religion.
Islam.
But Islam hasn't been reformed.
No,
and as Robert
and it can't
Spencer,
be. I mean, you know.
Well, Robert Spencer said during the panel, he says, "Okay, we're not going to say it's completely impossible, but we certainly don't see it as."
I said last week,
it's
like trying to reform evil, you know, evil itself. You can't. Yeah. The nature of Muhammad
and,
is what
and we,
it was.
And we talked somewhat last week too. I actually laid out different Islam that I think make it really difficult to reform as compared to other religions. So
you know the people are what they are. I mean they submit or they don't submit, and those who have submitted are at war with us. Those who haven't are not.
Yeah.
But again, they are apologists for evil. And just one thing, and you know, and the response to my piece was great. Dozens of websites picked it up.
Oh yeah,
it.
I was going to ask you about your response. I was going to check a couple of these comments here because we've really got the chat room going.
I got a lot of comments, got everything, and then but there were a few people who actually they suggested after reading my piece that I was being politically correct and multiculturalist because I think they unlike them. I don't hold all Muslims responsible for the evils of Islam. And they do, you know, because they think I'm holding back.
Yeah,
I got to call
I
all
love
Muslims
it when
evil.
They say that you are one of the wimpy ones.
It's incredible.
Right?
It's like they're waging an inverted jihad where all Muslims, you know, have to be, you know, arrested or killed.
No.
That's their whole attitude.
And again, I always keep this standard in my mind, and I always go back to that article that was co-written by Yaron Brook and Alex Epstein when they talk about what is the proper approach to take in war. And what you do is that you identify the threat, and then you do whatever is necessary to eliminate the threat with minimal loss of life and liberty for the citizens on your side.
Right.
And it is not necessary for us to...
It's a waste of time, a waste of everything.
Resources.
To go after all. I mean, it's insane.
Besides being unjust, it's not the thing that we need to do to eliminate this threat. We can eliminate the threat with basically ignoring those people. Now, the thing that I think, you know, again, I think there's two different motives that would be behind the Andrew C. McCarthy position and also... Karen Lugo, who was the moderator of the panel, I think it's a sympathy for Muslims who want to have the nice religious life and wanting to be sort of altruistic about giving them their space, to speak.
At
our expense. And then the other thing is this unrealistic idea that these non-Muslim Muslims will be beneficial allies for us.
They've never been.
If,
10 years.
If we go out of our way to help them in some way.
They see us as suckers, even the ones who aren't jihadists.
A few may be, right? Okay.
Sure, but they're acting against the religion.
Yeah, and it's hard to weigh the effect of having them involved with us, because on the one hand, you'd say, well, they might be able to help us a little bit, maybe some intelligence, maybe just showing that we don't hate all Muslims.
Yep.
But then on the other hand, doesn't it put a good face on a religion that itself has very bad things about it?
It's evil. And
so we don't want to do anything that prevents us from giving the religion the criticism that it needs and pretending to be friends. You know, again, I go back to that Rand quote that I had from the Ayn Rand bot a couple weeks ago. I found it in the letters book. And it was that you shouldn't be friends with slaves while they're still slaves, because then all you do is prop up the regimes of their masters.
It's a great way of putting it.
I think that this applies to people who are at least, you know, fairly seriously involved in Islam, but not necessarily our enemies.
One of the worst things that you also from these non-Muslim Muslims is the fact that even they, when there's a horrific terrorist attack, they run to the rescue of Islam. They don't mention the fact that non-Muslims were just wiped out, murdered. They run to the rescue of Islam's reputation because they want to be associated with a nice religion, and Islam couldn't have been responsible for that. It's pathetic. It's disgusting. And I understand the impulse at times to try to, you know what, they're all evil and all, but the fact is they're not. They're not at war with us. The true believers are. They got to be pummeled. They got to be killed. And then the ones who are quote unquote peaceful will be even more peaceful after that, because I'm like, uh-oh.
Well, you know, and then maybe they'll have the impetus finally to go through that reform of the religion, because they
can't. I mean,
they certainly,
you know,
don't.
Like,
they don't have it now, right?
It's like, and, this, though. I mean, I was just saying something about Ayaan Hirsi Ali. You know, she.
Let me remind people the phone number if they want to call up and talk to you. Okay.
Please.
The number to call in if you want to talk to me or Bosch, mostly Bosch, because we're interviewing him right now. 760-888-5817. Go ahead and call in if you'd like to, 760-888-5817. Or you can type in some questions here on the chat as well if you have some questions or comments for Bosch. Go ahead and maybe put caps Bosch, because some of you guys are talking to each other there in the chat room too.
Yeah, if you have any questions, please.
Put for Bosch and then let me know the question.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali, the ex-Muslim, post 9/11, in good conscience, she could not continue being a Muslim. She saw the horror. She goes, I can't be part of this evil. And, you know, that's why in a lot of ways, technically speaking, you could say, well, the best Muslims are the ex-Muslims. But that's absolutely true. It really is. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, Ibn Warraq, Wafa Sultan, good people fighting against. And they didn't just leave Islam. They're in the battle to fight it, ideologically. And, you know, there were some people who actually read my piece and came to the conclusion that I must still be a Muslim somehow, because I don't want to kill all Muslims or at least call them all the enemy.
You know what?
That's incredible.
I think they really have the inability to comprehend this idea of indifference. Just saying, I'm not going to go after you as an enemy. I'm not going to make you my friend.
Yeah.
I don't have to do either. I can just choose not to associate with you. I'm going to keep a safe distance because I don't want to play Muslim roulette.
Right.
But I'm not going to go and act to try to strip your rights away or anything like this. I think people just don't understand. My favorite, though, of the reactions that you got was the one that apparently didn't even fully read your article or know anything about you. Because this one, there was some blogger that said, why did he go to Islam in the first place?
Right. Why did he become Muslim?
Yeah, why?
Like recently. As if I wasn't
I think you became Muslim at age 18
He had it in his head. I became Muslim at 18 and left only recently. And why the hell would I do that? I mean, it's just, he don't know. Why would he assume that? I don't know why he would assume. But that's the same guy who said that I must still be a Muslim. I mean, I must still harbor some Islam in me.
I loved it, though, because he did some very detailed analysis.
Yeah.
I mean, at least it looked intricate, and he used a whole lot of $12 words.
I won't say who it is. Yeah. You know, I don't want to give that.
Yeah, don't even.
He's a punk.
But at the same time, I think he also went around promoting
his
analysis.
Yeah, he went.
But he didn't do the research.
No, he didn't.
It was hysterical.
About me or about Islam. I mean, there are a few out there, and they've been marginalized rightfully. Their whole idea is, you know, they can't even conceive of the fact that there are people who call themselves Muslim who are not Muslim. Just because they call themselves Muslims doesn't mean that they're, you know, in on it. You know, they can call themselves, like people call themselves Catholic or a Christian or a Jew, but they're only culturally so. And, you know, I understand, though, in one sense, because we are at war and they want to end the threat. But that's not how you end it. You go end it, you know, militarily, ideologically, in every single way, you know, discredit Islam, expose it for what it is, for the evil that it is, and destroy the enemies. I mean, destroy the state sponsored terrorism first and foremost.
Yeah, I mean, there's basically two different battles. So there's the intellectual battle where we have to put out the arguments. We have to tell the truth about what the religion contains, give arguments as to why it's wrong, although some of it seems obvious to most of the world's civilized population. There's other parts of it that we might have to give a little bit more argument using our philosophical background. And then there's that battle.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. You know, you don't fight an ideology itself with bombs.
No.
The thing that you fight with bombs are the people who are animated by that ideology and waging war against you, which is your Al-Qaeda, your state sponsors of terrorism, the Taliban, et cetera. Now, so you've had the reactions to this piece from both sides of the spectrum. You've had the people who have misinterpreted you to say that you want to wage war against all Muslims,
Yes.
So you've had that extreme, and then you've had the other extreme that says you've gone too soft because
one of the guys said, argued against someone because someone accused me, do you want to, as you put it, no joke, you want to genocide Islam? And the guy said, The guy was offended because he said he's not calling for that, as in he
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's like, don't, you know, says, you stole my thunder.
Yeah, he says, don't give Bosch credit exactly. for calling for genocide.
Exactly, because that's what I want, more or less. It's hilarious. And so mentions here the fact that, yeah, I don't quote unquote look like Muslim. And that's true, technically speaking. But again, it just proves the fact that Islam is an ideology. And it's an ideology. It's not race. That's why when people criticize Islam, they think it's racism. It's stupid. You get blonde hair, blue eyed, red hair, you know, whatever. Muslims. And that's the big problem because, it, you know, sooner or later, we will see blonde hair, blue eyed Muslims start, you know, killing themselves to kill others. And that'll be a big problem to stop.
Yeah.
A hard way to stop.
Now, people are having discussions with themselves in the chat room.
Oh, if you have any questions.
Here, actually, here's one something okay. for you. It says, Bosch, I think you're getting this. He says, I think it's because you don't look like a Muslim.
Yeah, that's what I always respond to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because the person did cite my looks in that picture. And yeah, that's the dangerous thing. That, you know, that's what lets people think, well, it's a race. It's not a race.
It's an ideology.
It's an ideology.
It's a religion.
I mean,
now, there are those people, too, who say it isn't a religion.
Yeah, there are those people. And that's just they're protecting religion, like Bush. You know, the only thing Bush knew about Islam 9/11 was that it was a religion, and therefore he had to protect it. Because as far as I know, religion saved him. Wasn't he a born-again Christian because of his alcoholism, whatever? Oh, man. So he ran to the rescue of religion. So when he said Islam is peace, he really meant religion is peace. And his idiotic advisor, David Forte, who I called the villain on 9/11, he told Bush whatever he wanted to hear. He said, nothing this evil can come from religion.
Yeah.
And it sure as hell did come from religion. It was an act of faith.
We have a caller. Maybe somebody wants to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Here we go. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. This is Debbie.
Hey, Debbie.
How are you?
Hello. Good, good. You know, I just, I really agree, Bosch, with your wanting to name the enemy Islam and not something else, some kind of distortion, because I just think it's so important for, especially for these Muslims who are honestly not engaging in some kind of stealth jihad and who actually don't and harm anyone and perhaps don't even understand what Islam is.
They
it's
don't,
so important
in general.
To recognize the nature of their religion. I mean, I had a similar experience with Christianity. I'm a former Christian, and for like a decade or more after I quit, in essence, being a Christian, I'd still kind of refer to myself as one. But then when I heard the DIM hypothesis lectures, I all of a sudden understood a lot more what it really means. And that was when I finally said, no, I'm an atheist, and started actually speaking out against some aspects of Christianity. And I think that similarly, maybe it could have that effect on
right.
Muslims. If they were
I think so. I mean, some of them, I think, become ashamed that they're part of such a religion. It's like, and they might actually, you know, pull themselves back after that, after it's exposed as such. Because a lot of them, you know, they're told that their religion is great, so like, okay, good. I don't have to leave my religion. If it's exposed as the evil that it is, they might start backtracking on it. They might start, you know, because they just call themselves Muslims. They might not even call themselves Muslims anymore.
Well, and as Robert Spencer said, so many of them haven't read the Quran.
No, true.
So they don't even.
I might
know.
Be the only one in my family who actually read the Quran. I have a big family.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just the way it is. They don't understand the religion. Whenever I comment on a religion, they don't want to hear it. And, you know, but they want to be part of something. It's like my private Islam for each and every one of them.
Right.
Know? Islam is a good thing, and that's all I know.
So Deborah, if people had basically taken the approach of giving you your rhetorical space and not insulting your religion as bad or anything like that, if they had pulled punches, you think you might still be religious today?
Well, I don't think that I really was religious since the age of 14. But it was just sort of a marginal, like if I heard people talking about Christianity in the context of politics, I would maybe think to myself, well, they're just wrong that that's the way to defend capitalism, you know, like when conservatives do it. And I would think, yeah, they're just sort of innocently mistaken. They're not going to successfully defend capitalism that way. But I didn't see it as a threat until, like I said, I heard the DIM hypothesis lectures, and it, all of a sudden that made something click, and it was like getting hit in the face with the truth. And then that was what gave me the impetus to really just explicitly think about it and say, no, okay, I understand now that there's something wrong with this, and that it's actually something that I have to actively fight. And it was really hard, but you need that impetus of being hit in the face with the truth in order to take such a fundamental step, because it's so hard to denounce something that you were taught all your life was so fundamentally, metaphysically, ethically, everything just so important.
And that you thought that you thought was part of you and almost defined you. I mean, that's how Muslims feel in a lot of ways. I mean, that's why, you know, when Muslims, they give credit to Islam for whatever virtues they have, especially Western Muslims, and they shouldn't. They really shouldn't. Because the peaceful Muslims are not peaceful because of Islam. They're not. They're peaceful because they're on personal
choices.
They're
enabling
them. Yeah. Absolutely. They are given the enemy cover, and that's the problem. It really is.
They are, and that's so wrong, because if more of these innocent Muslims really had to face it, and there weren't so many people trying to help them lie to themselves, they wouldn't be there as a cover for all these stealth jihadists,
right.
And there wouldn't be this problem of as what you call Muslim roulette, which I love, by the way. I think that's a perfect term for it. You never know when one's going to explode
in
your face.
You really don't.
Or I mean, you know, not even just necessarily blow himself up. There was the guy who was the respected television producer, news producer up in Canada, and he did an honor killing of his wife.
He was trying to promote quote unquote moderate Islam, literally on a TV show. He ends up cutting his wife's head off.
Oh,
I mean, this is I think a year or two ago, Jihad Watch had it all, and this is just. No one thought that. And then I think Robert said, "Moderate Muslim cuts, you know, wife's head off," because that's what he described himself as, you know.
Wow.
I mean, he went Islam, you know. He went Islam after his wife hurt him, whatever, emotionally, who knows what, but he fell back, and that's also a problem, because you know, when a Western Muslim's life goes sour, usually they fall back into Islam. Usually they do.
That's
for
right.
Salt.
Well,
and then
you
they
fall
start
back
getting,
on what you're
yeah,
familiar with.
And they start getting, quote unquote, they start getting religion. And that leads to, mm-hmm. you know, them becoming jihadists.
I mean, it's obviously not inevitable, but we're talking about the, you know, if they have those criminal elements within them and they want something to rest upon and give them a bit of sanction,
they can
find it.
They start justifying it. Say, well, I want to kill. Yeah. I feel like killing right now. So you know what? Let me go back to Islam because I can get a green light for that.
I just want to give one plug. So Deborah mentioned in her comment here when she was talking to us about the DIM hypothesis. And there's a lot of people online who have no idea what the DIM hypothesis is. So Leonard Peikoff gave some lectures on something called the DIM hypothesis, which is the title of a book that he has coming out next year. He did just recently send off the finished text to the publisher about mid-November or so. I got an email, and you know, he's very happy with it, and it got sent off finally. So sometime next year, I think it's by fall of next year, that this book will be out. So you can go to peikoff.com, peikoff.com, if you want to learn more about this book and the thesis and how it could give Deborah this idea of the negative influence of religion, not just the fact that the Christian argument is not a good one to defend capitalism by, but that the ethics that is embodied in it and then the entire epistemological approach undercuts you know, our free society. So that's just a little plug there. Thanks for bringing it up, though, Deborah.
Yeah, thanks, Deborah.
Sure, I'm glad to hear that the book's coming out next fall. I've been waiting eagerly for it and looking for an update about when it's going to be released. So I'm glad.
Yeah, I mean, all I know is that if it was about Herman Cain's mistress or whatever, the book would be out next week. But since it's an important book on philosophy, it's got to wait until next year, even though, like I said, Leonard Peikoff turned in the final text a few weeks ago.
So
that's just kind of the way things go. I guess probably he's got some sort of editor proofreader there too, but I know it doesn't take months to turn something like that out. I don't know how to pronounce this name of the person
Ozua.
In the chat room here. Ozua says it would be out in one day if it was Cain. Somebody's got to write the book. I think it takes a little bit more than one day. I've heard of people who can write books in a couple
weeks
to a month,
exactly,
which is amazing.
I've heard that.
But
those books aren't that memorable, though, usually.
Usually, perhaps. Oh, my gosh. So, Deborah, anything else before we go on to our next wonderful topic of Obamacare?
Well, I'm not done.
No. No, but I'll probably have something to say about Obamacare.
Well, you can either hang on and then just type a little chat in the text, a little notation in the text, and let me know you want to talk again or whichever you like.
I'm going to recite from the Quran.
No more. Okay, so we are just about at the top of the hour. If you're just joining us, this is Don't Let It Go Unheard. And in this first hour, we talked about Senate Bill 1867 and debunked, I think, the idea that it poses a tremendous threat to us in terms of the president deeming you and me a terrorist and hauling us off to Guantanamo or perhaps shipping us overseas. I just didn't see the language in there that supported that myself on my reading. You can check for yourself. Then we just had an interview with Bosch Faustin, who is very kindly coming here for an interview since he's here every day anyway, just talking about his article. And now I'd like to talk about an article that surprised me. It was in Forbes, and it appeared, I guess, on Friday, but I saw it going around Twitter yesterday. And the article was written by Hallelujah. Okay, so I'm thinking, maybe this is somebody who's happy that there's a certain bomb that's exploding that's going to undermine Obamacare itself. But no, as I read the article, he is referring to this following provision. He says, there's a provision of the law called the medical loss ratio that requires health insurance companies to spend 80% of the consumer's premium dollars they collect, 85% for large group insurers, on actual medical care rather than overhead, marketing expenses, and profit. Failure on the parts of insurers to meet this requirement will result in the insurers having to send their customers a rebate check representing the amount in which they underspend on actual medical care. Okay, I'm going to continue to quote. He says, "This is the true bomb contained in Obamacare, and the one item that will have more impact on the future of how medical care is paid for in this country than anything we've seen in quite some time," end quote. Now, this is why. Why is it that this is going to affect how medical care is paid for? It is because, and this author concedes, that no profit-making company is going to be able to exist under this scheme where they are not able to spend any more than 15 or 20%, you know, depending on how big they are, on, again, overhead, right? All those people who go through the paperwork and man the phones and stuff, marketing expenses, and profit. Again, profit is in there. So 15 to 20% is the most that they can have for those things. And I don't know that any company is going to be able to survive exactly that way. And the author here, Rick Unger, is not at all unhappy about it. He says, "Indeed, it is this aspect of the law that represents the true death panel found in Obamacare, but not one that is going to lead to the death of American consumers. Rather, the medical loss ratio will ultimately lead to the death of large parts of the private for-profit health insurance industry." So this guy's saying this bomb went off on Friday. So as of Friday, all of our insurance companies, our private insurance companies, have to operate under this constraint that only 20% at most, 15% for large insurers, can be spent on overhead, marketing expenses, and profit. So what's going to happen? They're going to go out of business. And if there's no insurance company that can insure us because they all go out of business, then we have single payer. Yeah. And this guy is gloating, and he's on Forbes.com. I guess because I've read articles on Forbes from objectivists, from other conservatives. I wasn't aware that they have with people who would gloat.
I've seen like Investor's Business Daily, they have from the left, they have quote unquote from the right. Sometimes they have.
Maybe that's what they were doing.
Articles.
So here's a.
And this guy's gloating that we're all going to be slaves. And that's what he's, you know, he can't wait to be a slave, but he wants everyone else to be.
Here's a taste of the gloating. He says, quote, "If you believe that the end of private for-profit health insurance is some type of nefarious step towards a socialist society, then you might want to attend church this Sunday to mourn the loss of health insurers being able to worm out of covering the bills of a cancer patient because she forgot to write down on her application that she had skin acne for 3 months when she was a teenager," end quote. So he says everyone wins. This is the last couple lines. He says everyone wins except for the for-profit health insurers. I can live with that. So he wants for-profit in the healthcare industry to go away.
Yep.
And it sounds like maybe he's going to get his wish unless the Supreme Court overturns it or we get a candidate who will repeal it. One candidate who probably would have repealed it is out, and that is Herman Cain.
Yep.
We saw the not-so-graceful exit of Cain this last weekend, his little press conference on Saturday where he made this announcement of suspending his campaign. I tweeted about it. You can go read there. But, you know, he delayed and delayed and delayed, and he had a bunch of people giving him these great speeches of introduction and how much they support him. Yeah, and they spoke equivocally as if he might still be running.
Right,
one of them even asked for campaign volunteers to continue to volunteer.
They might not have known themselves.
Maybe.
You want to keep it close to the vest.
But some people said that they knew that once his wife showed up, that probably he was going to be withdrawing from the campaign, suspending the campaign, whatever, because she probably wouldn't sit there and
I guess so.
You know, condone this to go on and on. Because, I mean, no doubt the negative attention it's been, you know, drawing her. But with Cain, the way that he uses language, I don't think it serves anybody very well to parse it. I tried to parse it.
Yeah.
He said false and unproven accusations, right?
That's pretty funny.
These false and unproven accusations.
You can't prove it.
So I was saying, okay, well, he's the one who is the subject of the accusations. He has evidence as to whether the allegations or the accusations are true or false. He actually knows whether what these people are saying contradicts reality. So why would he be referring to them as unproven? Now, I would refer to them as unproven because I don't have facts of reality that would contradict.
And he also he confessed to having some kind of relationship with this woman for 13 years.
Yeah.
He did, whatever it was.
Yeah. So anyway, it was just kind of sad. He did say he's at peace with his God and at peace with his wife, but that didn't necessarily mean too much to me because both might be forgiving him.
Exactly.
And
he's religious. And, you know, religion forgives, right?
So it was sad. I thought that people were too harsh on him in general. But at the same time, it is not these scandals that did him in, though.
Absolutely.
It really was not. I think it was the fact that he was inequipped in certain situations, especially foreign policy discussions.
Yeah.
That, I think, really did hurt him. And I don't think that even without these scandals that, I don't know, if he had done a bit more homework and he hadn't had these scandals.
Yeah. I mean, if he knew his stuff. And the fact is, if you run for president of the United States of America, you better know your stuff, especially at his age. And he didn't. You know, he was good. I liked him because he's a non-politician.
Well, and he'd been a talk show host for years, too,
for years,
which means
exactly.
that he's supposedly in the trenches doing what I'm doing every week, which is studying
was
up
he?
On this stuff, right?
I don't know.
It could be that he had a research staff that prepared things for him.
Maybe.
Ooh, wouldn't that be
Maybe.
Nice? I want one.
I wish I had one now, though. I wish
Yay.
I had one, you know, in the last few months. He didn't do his homework, and when he really was flat-footed, he should have went to one-on-one, you know, to know his stuff, and he didn't do that. Mm-hmm. He didn't.
So what are we left with now? We've got Gingrich, Romney, Bachman, Santorum.
We got a Newt and a Mitt. What the hell kind of name is it? But anyway, a Newt and a Mitt left.
Yeah, and this is the funny. We've all been talking about, okay, well, it's going to be Newt or it's going to be Mitt, and which one's worse? It's probably going to be one of those two.
Probably.
And we're almost at the point of flipping a coin because they both have their negatives to them. But I just thought of something that's even worse. What if it's Mitt and Newt?
Oh, exactly.
What if it's Mitt and Newt? Does that make you throw up more than anything? I don't know. This week I said I officially downgraded my anticipated voting experience that I had anticipated holding my nose, but it's now been downgraded to barf bag required no matter what happens. And I'm afraid that's true. But again, I mean, we just saw another bomb in Obamacare. This bomb just went off. It's going to put private insurers out of
That's
business unless
purpose.
It is ended.
You want to wipe
and if the court doesn't invalidate it, we've got to repeal it. Otherwise, those companies go out of business. We're back to single.
Deborah brings up here that Gingrich has said that he has strongly spoken. You know, he has spoken strongly against. I mean, about repealing Obamacare. I mean, whoever, if he's going to repeal it, then yeah, it's worth voting for him. If he's going to repeal it, but Romney, why the hell would he repeal it? Philosophically, politically, why would he do that? He wouldn't do that. He enacted socialized medicine. He's a socialist. I call him a socialist, you know, for a Republican. He's slow. But is Nuke going to repeal it? Would he repeal it? I don't know. He's a big government guy, too.
We're going to have to go read their websites and see their plans and decide whether we believe them. Bachman, we know, wants to repeal it. It's a huge, huge priority.
She's the only one who probably would kill it. She probably would. Find a way, find somehow, some way, and she has a passion to do it. These guys, I don't think their heart's in it. The only reason why they speak about it is because the people do. The Americans do. That's what Tea Party, we want it dead. And they're like, okay, we'll follow suit.
Now, Chris here says, can we trust either of them to repeal Obamacare? I'm not convinced.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know either. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if there's a choice between Newt or Mitt repealing Obamacare, I'd say Newt, because he didn't install, you know, Newt care.
Right.
I mean, Gingrich care.
And I was fairly convinced by his explanation as to why he switched from being in favor of an individual mandate and going against it. He had originally been talked into an individual mandate by the Heritage Foundation
trying to back off ever since.
It was going to be an antidote to Hillary Care. By the way, can I tell my Hillary Care story? Because I think my favorite politics on the floor of the House or Senate, I can't remember. I think it was Senate. That story comes at the time of Hillary Care. I don't know if you guys remember Phil Gram from Texas. I think he was a senator, Phil Gram?
I believe it was, yeah.
And they said he wasn't electable because of his appearance or demeanor or whatever.
His whole style, yeah.
I seem to remember somebody said he looked sort of turtle-like or something. I can't remember.
Poor guy. I can say that.
All I remember was that, and I was young, so sorry if I don't remember perfectly, but I was so impressed with what he did because they had that huge, huge piece of legislation.
Right.
And Hillary was going around saying that there are no taxes or penalties in it. No taxes or penalties that were going to be put, I guess, on doctors. Anyway, so they're telling these lies about this thing, and they give it to the senators a day or two before they have to vote on it. They say, here it is. So poor Phil Gram, he gets his whole staff, and they're combing through this huge stack of paper. There are no page numbers on it.
Deliberately so.
No page numbers. Yep. So he gets on the floor of the Senate, and he says, look, I'm putting the whole thing on the scale.
Right.
It weighs, you know, X pounds, however many ounces. And if you go down X number of ounces, here is the first tax, and then he reads it off, and then he goes, go down two more ounces, and then you find that, and he goes through the whole thing that way by weight, and it was to me, funny, but awesome, too, and then I think he also said that this thing will pass over my cold, dead political body. Maybe. Wasn't he the one who said that?
I don't know, but that's the kind of language that we need, and we don't hear that from anyone.
No.
We don't.
No. I mean, and this is sort of why, to me, the thing that's just so sad is, we had all the tremendous energy of the Tea Parties.
Yep.
And what we're looking at front runners are the old recycled guys.
Absolutely. It's unbelievable.
Romney and Gingrich. These guys are not Tea Party energetic, new.
Bolton didn't run. Paul Ryan didn't run.
Yeah.
Giuliani didn't run. I don't know what the hell. Why the hell didn't they run? I don't get it. This is the time.
Yeah.
This is the time. You got to knock this guy out, knock Obamacare, save us. They're thinking, in the future. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like they're absolute corrupted politicians mentally. They're like, well, 2016, that sounds better for me personally. Say, how about the country? You know, you got to come in. And, I mean, Paul Ryan, he was talking about it, and maybe, and then I think Rubio, maybe someone was talking about him to be maybe a vice president. I don't know. But this is the time. This. And they didn't come through.
Yeah.
You know? Whatever sick reason, I don't know.
I don't know. Supreme Court, maybe we hope that they have some sense. Some people say Allen would be good. We saw
Yes, we did.
We saw a speech by Allen at Restoration Weekend.
He's the second most honest politician about Islam on earth after Geert Wilders. he has somewhat changed his you know, terminology a little, but still he's very honest about it. And he, in his speech.
Yeah, he was the only one at Restoration Weekend to actually mention Ayn Rand in his speech.
Yeah, and we thanked him for it. We shook his hand and said thanks.
Yeah.
And he was cool.
And I think he's religious. So
he
it's
is.
Not, yeah,
but he doesn't,
not that he's an objectivist.
I don't think it's on his sleeve.
He respects her and her ideas, which is, I think that was really good.
That was great.
I don't think that they paid him
he
to
read
do
it
for our benefit.
No, he read it, and we walked up and said, yeah, we're... objectivists.
Yeah, we're fans. We're the token objectivists at Restoration Weekend.
We're also with Glenn Beck. I don't know if you mentioned it. You know,
we met Glenn Beck. We told him we were the token patriotic atheists in the audience.
And he said, God bless. Or not.
Or not.
It was pretty funny.
That's right. No, it was definitely funny. So, okay, I need to now talk to you about privacy issues. So, Bosch got to talk about his pet topic, which
I'm
is
not
Islam.
Done.
I get to talk about...
I just started.
You just started talking about Islam. Well, I'm talking about privacy. So
okay.
Islamic privacy, I don't
hey.
Know. Yeah. How much privacy do women have in Islam? I guess a lot if you say that they are covering themselves
right.
out in public, but not really because
no.
they have absolutely no ability to determine their own lives. So in privacy, the big news this week was that the Federal Trade Commission and Facebook reached a settlement agreement on privacy. And the FTC had filed before complaints against Facebook. So I got the story from the New York Times, November 29th. It says, accusing Facebook of engaging in unfair and deceptive business practices, the federal government on Tuesday announced a broad settlement that requires the company to respect its users' wishes on privacy and subjects it to regular privacy audits for the next 20 years. It says, the strongly worded order announced at the Federal Trade Commission in Washington stems largely from the changes that Facebook made to the way it handled its users' information in December 2009. It alleged that Facebook, without warning its users or seeking consent, made public information that they had deemed to be private in their Facebook pages. So a lot of people said, yay, Facebook was messing around with privacy policies.
Yeah.
It's so good that they went ahead and, you know, changed these things, you know, that the government's basically going to protect us, that it's going to supervise Facebook, slap it down because it had messed around with its privacy policies. So, you know, they did some bad things. The government said, no, you can't do it. Facebook reached a settlement agreement. And, in fact, Mark Zuckerberg was happy about it. He says, you know, this is a statement that he released on November 29th. He says, I founded Facebook on the idea that people want to share and connect with the people in their lives. But to do this, everyone needs complete control over who they share with at all times. And then he goes on to say, I admit that we've made a bunch of mistakes. He says, in particular, I think a small number of high-profile mistakes, and he said Beacon 4 years ago, which I hadn't heard of, but he says, also a poor execution as we transitioned our privacy model 2 years ago, have often overshadowed much of the good work we've done. And then he goes on to say that he's eager to work with the federal government in the settlement agreement.
Sure.
We're going to work with regulators to inform them of our privacy practices and policies. So any lists a bunch of new privacy initiatives. Now, I wanted to go see for myself what all the hubbub was about, what the complaint was about, what the settlement requires. And I think it's really bad. And you can decide whether you agree with me or not. You can call in to talk to me about it if you like. It's 760-888-5817, 760-888-5817. And, in fact, I do have a caller on the line here, so I'm going to go ahead and try to take the call. Hello, you're on.
Hello. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Amy, this is Harold in Florida. I've been on hold since you were talking about Herman Cain earlier, and my comments were related to that whole discussion. Now that he's dropped out, I'm looking at Michelle Bachmann again, and I went and I listened to the old interviews of her with Robert Ringer, the publisher, the author, and she seems to be fairly good, except for her, you know, religious side.
Right.
On the abortion issue, and also I went to look at her voting record, and that looks okay too. She was willing to stand against the Republicans on some of these economic issues where they would just go along.
Right.
So the question now is, She's at 8% in the polls, and there's less than a month to go before the you know, the caucuses and in Iowa. If there's going to, in my mind, the big thing is to decide whether she's the one. If she is the one, it's easy to give her a push. She has this call fire system. That's where you people can make calls from their homes, and it goes through a centralized, you know, website. And basically, it's like a remote call center for the site. We did that with Peter Schiff in Connecticut, and he went from like 4% up to like 23%. In other words, half the people we called, we were able to pull over to his site. But he was a dream of a candidate, very easy. Everything was well known about him. And Michelle Bachmann, there's some black holes there. I don't know. What did she do all the years she was at the IRS? Was she helping or hurting people? I don't know. It's a mystery.
Right.
So, you know, she's not as well known. And there's,
but she might get Kane's followers. She might.
I'm wondering who Kane is going to endorse. That's one issue. Now, Sarah Palin seems to be pushing towards Santorum based on tweets that I've seen over the last couple days. She keeps praising Santorum. So to me, he's bad. I mean, if you're going to choose one of the more religious candidates, I would like Bachmann over him.
Absolutely.
But, you know, the thing that bothered me about Bachmann in that foreign policy debate that was the last weekend was when she talked about Pakistan being too nuclear to fail.
Right.
And that we need to just basically continue to keep giving them money and being their friends because they have nukes. Now, she was getting this from Bolton, so it's not like you can completely blame her. She's got a pretty decent foreign policy expert who's advising her on this. I you know, we just have all these bad choices.
And we do have bad choices.
I have really liked a lot of what Bachmann has had to say, and I particularly like the fact that she insists on repealing Obamacare.
Yeah, she says
first
again.
Thing.
She says it with conviction, with passion, unlike the other guys.
Yeah.
Romney says as a campaign line.
Yeah.
Some of the points that Robert Ringer makes, he says she needs to stop talking about the 23 foster children.
Right.
No, don't bring that up more than once a month. Just,
she brings it up 23 times during the debate.
What relevance does that really have
to
the presidential
campaign?
I'm trying
to say I'm good.
Yeah, I'm. You know, like me, please like
right.
me, because
right.
I'm so compassionate. But it's absolutely irrelevant to the presidential campaign. She needs to be fixed on the economic issues and foreign policy and nothing else.
Yeah. She's pretty good on all those.
I agree. I haven't decided yet, but so your point is that if we were to get behind her, it would be possible to go ahead and get on some phones and try to move the polls in her direction, yeah?
Yeah, I'll tell you what we actually did in Connecticut. It was pretty amazing because we didn't exactly have a very conservative audience. The registered Republicans there's about 430,000. We called half of them. We called like 220,000. I myself personally called 2,700 people in a month.
Wow.
And
wow.
I got through to 10% of them. The rest of them I left detailed messages, and we were able to sway half of them. That's how things work. People are swayable, but you need to have a really good candidate. And I don't know if she is that excellent candidate that you can sway people with.
She's
she's
more appealing than Gingrich and Romney. I mean,
I guess I like her more than them. The thing is, for me, I'm talking about having to have a barf bag at the polls just to vote. Never mind get on the phone and try to convince other people to vote for somebody. So.
They have to give us reasons, and they haven't.
Yeah.
They haven't given us great reasons to vote for them.
You know, I would talk about this more, and I would definitely let's try to revisit some more of the candidate talk next week. I do want to get through this stuff on Facebook privacy, if that's okay with you, Harold. Is that okay?
Yeah, sorry. I didn't mean to divert you.
No worries. Let's talk about it more because it's starting to get down to the wire. So
yeah, one quick point. Mm-hmm. As it gets closer to Christmas and as it gets closer to the caucuses, Romney and whoever else has money is going to spam everyone. They're going to jam their mailboxes with stuff, and nobody's going to want to hear from us. We will not be able to get through to them. It'll be too late because they will not want to hear from anyone at that point. It has to happen in the next 2 weeks or forget about it.
So your message is if people want to jump behind someone like Bachmann, they should go to her website, and at her website they have facilities where you can call via the web?
I, I was able to read through the lines. I saw a TV interview with her, and she mentioned that, and immediately, because I'd done it before, I knew exactly what she was talking about. It wouldn't be clear to most people. I don't see it on the website, but I'm sure if you call in and you ask them how to do it, it's called Call Fire. They might be using some other system.
Okay.
But generally, it gives out the caller ID of the campaign, and meanwhile, you're at home, and you have like a control panel on your screen. You can see the names and addresses and so forth, and you call, and then the system calls out, and you make comments, and you tick boxes like don't call again or this person, you know, whatever you want to do. You have control.
Okay, great.
And then the only trouble with Bachman is she's not doing a weekly report back to her people working for her. So with Schiff, he gave us a report every week. We knew how many people were calling. We knew what our numbers were. You need feedback. And if
yeah.
she's not engaged in the process, it doesn't inspire other people.
No,
it sounds like her campaign. But I think she had some personnel changes in her campaign, if I recall correctly, too. So she may have had some problems there. Thanks, Harold, for letting us know. Sorry, I did cut you off. Sorry, I clicked the button before I knew you were going to still talk, Harold. Sorry about that. So let me go ahead and talk about this Facebook settlement. So, again, Facebook did some things seemingly bad. A lot of people were upset about Facebook and their privacy policy. And Federal Trade Commission comes and slaps them down. And Mark Zuckerberg seems happy with it, and he's happy to work with them. Doesn't
he likes
seem
to be
good.
Slapped down by government.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
likes it.
So I figured, okay, well, why don't I go read the complaint, what did all the things that Facebook actually did wrong, and what it is that they're settling about, and then let's look at the settlement agreement and see, you know, how bad it is. And the complaint itself boils down to a number of cases of misrepresentation by Facebook. So, yeah, misrepresentation is bad. If you can find that a business is guilty of fraud or misrepresentation, then, yeah, they should have some sort of damages
government
that they have
doesn't,
to
doesn't do that. Yeah.
Go. No, government doesn't do that at all.
Oh,
never misrepresent.
Never.
During, no, no.
Never.
But one of government's jobs
yes,
is to redress any injury that's due to.
Right now, in
the
post-Obama
era, yeah.
they're going to try to get a power grab at every point that they can.
Okay, back to Facebook.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's what I'm talking about Facebook.
No,
anyway,
you're not.
I am.
You're talking about government power grabs. Oh,
yes.
This one. Oh, okay. Well, let's talk. Okay, so. Misrepresentation, Facebook engaged in it, and here are a few things. One of them was that some things that had formerly been protected as private became public, I think inadvertently on Facebook's part, because of this transition that they made to their new privacy policies in December of 2009. So there were some things that they were saying, you know, you can have it just as private as you had before, using our new controls, but really people weren't able to. So that was a misrepresentation. The other thing is that people were under the impression that their privacy settings were always in operation. And it turned out that if you added some of these applications, a lot of these silly games and everything that you play on Facebook, maybe Farmville or who knows, the different applications, that some things become public through the applications. And it's not always just those things that are, quote, necessary for the application to work. It seemed that the applications had access to all sorts of information from your profile. And then the third thing that, main thing that they got them on was information that was shared with advertisers. The FTC thought that Facebook had misrepresented the extent to which and the amount of information of yours that was shared with advertisers there on the site. So you'd say, okay, misrepresentation, definitely government should do something about it to redress it. So what does the order say? This is the actual order, the consent order that Facebook is agreeing to. It says it's for settlement purposes, that the respondent expressly denies the allegation, so Facebook is actually still denying that they're guilty of the misrepresentation. But again, all the charges in the complaint had to do with misrepresentation about the privacy policies. So what is it that they promised to do? What they promised to do is not misrepresent, right? This makes sense. This is Roman numeral 1. It is ordered that Facebook shall not misrepresent in any manner expressly or by implication the extent to which it maintains the privacy or security of covered information. And then it has a list of all the different situations. Now, this seems fine, right? Because you say, oh, if you're redressing misrepresentation, then you want to make sure that in the future Facebook does not misrepresent the extent to which it shares information in these various contexts. The only problem, though, is that it talks about various places of sharing information to third parties. So it talks about, for instance, don't misrepresent the extent to which you make or have made covered information accessible to third parties. It talks about the steps that Facebook takes or has taken to verify the privacy or security protections that the third party provides, the extent to which respondent makes or has made covered information accessible to any third party following the deletion of your account, right? Because sometimes Facebook maybe would make information accessible to a third party after your account was deleted if the third party had, for instance, the URL to your video. They could still access it. That was the kind of thing that they're talking about. But the interesting thing is, who are third parties? As of the time of this consent decree, a third party seems not to include the government itself. Excluded from the term third party is, quote, any entity that uses the covered information only as reasonably necessary either to comply with the applicable law, regulation, or process, or to enforce respondents' terms of use. So since the government is going to be enforcing the respondents' terms of use, maybe. It's not going to be qualified as a third party. I'm concerned about who is a third party under this is what I'm saying. But this is not the most egregious thing. The most egregious thing here is that the order does not stop there. The order, which is about redressing problems due to Facebook's misrepresentation about its privacy practice, the order goes to the substance of Facebook's privacy practices. Okay? So it says, for instance, if the respondent is going to disclose or share non-public user information which materially exceeds the restrictions imposed by the user's privacy settings, then little warning bells have to go off and you have to affirmatively consent whenever there's going to be a disclosure that materially exceeds whatever you had agreed to before. Then it says information cannot be accessed by the third party from servers under respondent's control after a reasonable time not to exceed 30 days. So it's telling Facebook substantively, you have to make sure that 30 days at the latest, the old picture links, the old video links are not accessible anymore to anyone out there. So it's another point of substance that the government's telling Facebook what it has to do. Says it is further ordered that no later than the date of service of this order, establish and implement and thereafter maintain a comprehensive privacy program. And it has to be reasonably designed to address privacy risks, protect the privacy and confidentiality of covered information. The program has to be documented in writing. It has to be having controls and procedures appropriate to the respondent's size and complexity. So a huge program it's required to implement in order to control substance. I mean, basically, Facebook misrepresented. It was bad. It committed fraud. And then the government comes in and uses the fact that it was maybe guilty of misrepresentation, Facebook denies it, as a reason to control the substance of Facebook's policies. In effect, the FTC, the hook that it has as an opportunity to dictate privacy policy. It is no longer at Facebook's discretion to say, okay, well, here's our contract. You read it. If you don't like it, you don't have to do business with us. You can decide either way. Now the government is going to be dictating Facebook's privacy policy effective immediately. And if you read, if you go on Facebook and see it, he talks about the two privacy officers that he has already appointed. Then it says the respondent is going to obtain initial and biennial assessments by an independent third-party professional. So this privacy program is going to be assessed independently And the person who's going to do the assessment has to have a minimum of 3 years' experience in the field of privacy and has to be approved by the Associate Director of Enforcement at the Federal Trade Commission. And these reviews have to go on for 20 years. Okay? 20 years.
They saw their chance and took it.
And there's all sorts of documents that the FTC is entitled to review. So it just goes on and on and on. My question for you is, do you think that if Facebook was guilty of misrepresenting aspects about its privacy policy and how much control you had over it and how you got control over it, does that give the government the ability to control the substance of those privacy policies for 20 years after that? I mean, that's really the question. Now, Martin here says, Facebook misrepresented my writing about Islam to mean that I wanted to hook up with Muslim women. Now, it is true they had those policies of, you know, detecting, and they still do. You can tweet about anything. If I tweet about pot roast or something, or not tweet, but, you know, put a status statement about pot roast, then suddenly I'll have a slow cooker ad in the right-hand column of Facebook. But I was really horrified, and then I learned that it's not just Facebook that is undergoing this. It is also Google, Twitter. They have recently reached so-called settlement agreements with the Federal Trade Commission. I have not read those settlement agreements, but now I'm wondering if the Federal Trade Commission coming in on the pretense, and it's not necessarily a pretense, but there is maybe legitimate, you know, causes of action that they have against Facebook, because Facebook arguably misrepresented certain things, relatively minor, I would say, but you'd say some customers are entitled to damages.
Well, government sees it as a pretext to dive in.
Yeah.
And take control.
And so then they say, well, you misrepresented what your policies were. So now, not only are we going to slap you on the hand or fine you or whatever for your misrepresentations, we'll just come in and take over your entire privacy policy and tell you what you should do with respect to privacy. And I think that's just entirely wrong.
Like
Facebook,
TSA, when it comes
Facebook
to
if it wanted to, if Facebook wanted to, it should be able to tomorrow say, hey, if you post here, then it goes public. We're going to give your house address to all these advertisers, and they're going to send you junk mail, you know, whatever it is. And then you get out. You just say, forget it, Facebook. I don't want this. And instead now we've got government supervision over those policies. The government's going to control it. And maybe some people like that, but I like the idea that we have the most control over our relationship with these companies by the contracts that we have with them. And you know,
that's part of the appeal,
you choose your social network. You want to go to Google Plus because you think that gives you more control over with whom you share certain things, then go there. And I want to see competition between these guys, and I want to see people make informed choices. I hate this idea that you've got nothing but a misrepresentation and that Facebook is now on the hook for 20 years to have its privacy policies dictated, essentially.
As if they're going to pull out after 20 years, as if.
Well,
once their claws are in, they're going to get deeper.
Yeah.
And who knows where they're going to go then? That's the government.
Well,
they grow.
And probably, I mean, what everyone is pushing for is for this to be achieved via legislation. They want Congress, and apparently there's some bills that are being thrown around in Congress. They want Congress to pass comprehensive legislation that's going to tell all these people what to do. But in the meantime, the FTC is coming up with ad hoc de facto legislation by means of these consent agreements with the various companies.
I think they're status envy because they can't go out there and speak their mind the way we do. You know what I mean? I mean, they are politicians, right? So they're like, well, we don't want people to, you know what I mean? Because they want to say all the things that we do, but they can't. Yeah, so it's status statement envy. That's what it is.
Now, if people want to talk about Facebook and let me know whether you are happy or sad that the government is grabbing this power. And I mean, maybe you're happy. Maybe you think Facebook was out of control and you want government to rein it in.
But Facebook is better than government. That's the thing. You mean they would be better at it? They would.
The number is 760-888-5817. Go ahead and give us a call if you'd like to.
Government poisons everything.
Chime in on this issue. I mean, what about you, Bosch? I mean, when you saw some of these changes that were coming down, I remember
I like
all
them.
The status
oh, yeah.
statements people were, oh my gosh, Facebook changed
well,
things. You have to.
I don't like it.
Actually, that's the thing that annoys me about right now.
Facebook is
the stacking.
Because you got totally different views on certain topics, but they all put them all together. If it's about Obama, you might have some people who are pro Obama, though I don't know if I have many friends who are pro Obama. But they have different things to say, and they put them all under one heading.
Yeah, for instance, if
then you got to look at them for 18 different things. You don't have, you just don't have time.
If you mentioned Herman Cain
right.
on Facebook, then your post would be stacked with all kinds of other people, and it would be pros and cons and all different aspects. Some of them could be talking about the scandal. Some could be talking about a policy issue. Who knows?
Yeah.
So, Facebook, yeah, you can decide whether or not you want to continue to do business with it, but I am not happy with this, and I'm kind of sad that you've got Zuckerberg saying, that he's oh so happy to work with Facebook.
It comes off to me like a leftist, like a punk leftist who likes government, and also a deer in the headlights guy. I mean, he seems like he's been caught, with his hand in the cookie jar almost, and he's like, okay, where he didn't commit a great crime. But Kyle says, the only reason they got away with it is because Facebook is so big. In a sense, I mean, it's like Facebook is too big for them not to be part of it, not to get their claws into it.
Yeah.
They look at the pretext of the privacy settings.
And this is the thing, again, the thing that I worry about is the back doors that'll come.
Yeah.
How much will the government be able to access things because of this continued supervision? When you've got someone who's willing to compromise, and this is the other thing too, I don't know if Facebook is aware of this, but I learned this in doing some work on the ethics rules, the rules of ethics that apply to lawyers, and I learned that when a company like Facebook turns over some information to the federal government for purposes, like they do it voluntarily for certain limited purposes, like reaching the settlement, then they give up privileges on it for all sorts of reasons. And so I think Facebook may have hurt itself even by dealing with them voluntarily at all.
Absolutely.
If they already and any information that they share with them
it's like
through this, I think they would lose privileges on too.
You let a wolf into the door and say, okay, we'll work with you. That wolf's going to, do their damage, do what wolves do, what snakes do.
Yeah.
I mean,
Martin here says it's just a rationalization for taking control over companies.
I
think so too. So this is the thing I was thinking of. So the FTC is making itself de facto by these consent agreements, these settlement agreements.
I used Zuckerberg before, and Deborah says, yes, Zuckerberg offered an enthusiastic sanction.
Yeah,
he absolutely did.
Yeah, Zuckerberg
did.
If
you ever see him in interviews, he looks like a deer in the headlights. He really does. And he's like, okay, I'll back down.
I don't think he has a philosophy that he can use to defend himself against it. I wrote him a short message. I know he probably won't read it. He's bombarded with such messages. But I said I really thought they got the short end of the stick big time. How in the world can you say that a misrepresentation about a policy justifies the government takeover of the policy?
And for him to be willing.
If Facebook has the right to set its policies, and the only problem is that it misrepresented those policies, then that's what should remain after the consent agreement. It's not like they give up the right to dictate their privacy policies.
Look at the government. I mean, look what they do. Look who they are. And look at the airlines, TSA.
And that's not me defending Facebook's privacy policies. I either like it or I don't like it. That's a whole separate matter.
We have freedom to leave. I mean, if we really are, it's just
another
power grab.
It makes me upset. So then I was starting to think about, do you want the government to come in and set up these sort of default arrangements, right? And I was thinking of the analogy. I was thinking of copyright. We don't mind, for instance, the government saying copyright has certain protection. It's going to be life plus 70 or 90 years for corporate creations or whatever. Whatever it is, there's certain standardized protections for intellectual property that the government sets up. So maybe it's not so bad to have this privacy protection, right? But there's some disanalogies between the situation of intellectual property and privacy, first of all, because privacy, you're not planning on, you know, selling this or getting money necessarily. You're just trying to figure out, you want to share things with your family and not with the whole world or whatever. So it's a whole different ballgame. The other thing is the type of case-by-case analysis that the FTC is doing here, and that I think any privacy legislation would require that case-by-case control. It's not going to be, you know, life plus 70 or, you know, certain standard procedures. It's going to say, you know, I mean, get back to the language of the order. It said that they have to have the sort of policies and procedures that are reasonably necessary given the size and complexity of their business, or, you know, some language
Martin,
like that.
Martin is quoting Milton Friedman. He goes, there's nothing as permanent as temporary government policy.
Yeah.
When they say 20 years, they mean forever. I mean, as far as they're concerned.
Yeah. I mean, there's this whole thing at the end about what happens at the end of the 20 years and if there's been court proceedings that it might extend longer because they violated it. So, you know, given
government grows,
given the rubbery language that's in here.
20 years. I mean, the way the government's going, in 20 years, they're going to be Facebook. They're going to own Facebook.
Yeah.
The way they're going. Unless we stop.
So, I think Zuckerberg has made a big mistake.
He made a deal with the devil.
Big mistake given in here. And so let me talk a little bit more about the disanalogies between copyright protection and privacy. So it's this case-by-case issue, and I don't think that you should have legislation that requires terms like reasonable or private or whatever to be applied case by case by case. You could have, for instance, the conception of the reasonable man. So you'd say, you know, what would the reasonable Facebook customer think he was signing on to in agreeing to this contract? And then you could have a contract case where you'd figure that out. But in terms of a government dictating what are reasonable privacy policies, given the size and complexity of the organization, when, I mean, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is the genius here, right? He's the one who thought of Facebook, thought of the ways that he can facilitate us to share personal things about ourselves, ideas with each other. And, you know, again, their whole goal was to try to make this sharing community where we can share all the information and stuff, make it as frictionless as possible. And I expect that under the control of the government, that you're going to have a lot clunkier experience as you're moving around. I mean, it's kind of clunky now already. And I think it's because Facebook already took it upon itself to implement some of the things that it's hoping the government will like.
Oh, yeah. Zuckerberg also signed the quote-unquote guilt pledge. Happily, like an idiot. He met with Obama as if Obama has anything to offer him in any way whatsoever, except to grease him.
And these politicians, you know, or the bureaucrats at the FTC, they don't understand the sorts of things that Zuckerberg has in mind.
All they understand is, as you know, Zuckerberg has, what, 300, 400 million people? What is it?
It's 750 million.
That's what they understand.
750
this guy
million,
has too much power.
Yeah.
We got to bring him down a little. We got to control this guy. You know, he's too young. He's too powerful.
How young is he?
I think he's in the late 20s. I might be wrong, but I think he's in the late 20s.
I mean, the guy's supposed to be a genius. And
but look at Jobs when it comes to his health.
Yeah.
They all have these black holes
of
stupidity.
I know. But I mean, it just blew my mind to say, okay, here's a complaint. All the complaints, all the counts of the complaint amount to misrepresentation. And then the
full control.
Yeah, I mean, the sanction is that they have to give up control over the substance of their policy.
That's their first thing, and they saw a willing victim. They said, "Hey, man, this guy's not resisting here. Let's really push him, make him feel guilty than he is, and you know, take it over." He's like, "Okay, bad move, very bad."
So I want to know if anybody in the audience here went from being happy that Facebook was being controlled a bit by the government, that it was told that it did some bad stuff, to not being happy with the content of this. Because the content of this settlement, to me, is just mind-blowing and depressing. Do you think Facebook should have to be supervised in its privacy policies for 20 years?
By the government, by the U.S. government.
Because it engaged in misrepresentation.
The bloated creature keeps growing.
I see no objections among our chat room people. Maybe they have become
pro-government.
They have become complacent.
That's it.
They are happy with the government dictating
Come
what
on, guys,
their
we're
privacy
trying to
is.
Get some.
They're having conversations among themselves.
Okay, let's talk about Islam. Islam means submission to the will of a malevolent God. Anyway.
Thank you.
Okay.
No.
That's it.
What about you? I mean, were you surprised that it was this bad?
Yes. Yes. I was surprised that he just bent over for the government. You know, he said, oh, okay. He likes it. I mean, clearly likes government for some reason. You know, he thinks it's a great value.
I mean, this is a train that has, you know, it started, took off from the station in 1890. It's been going and going and going. And now it's like high speed, full steam ahead. You've got the FTC taking over. Oh, now we have a lot of people going, doing too much soma, said Chris. No, people are saying, no, they're definitely not happy. Yeah, Kyle says he was naive because he assumed the government only retaliated against the misrepresentation. Yeah, that's what I would assume, too. And I'd be fine with that. That's what they should do.
But, you know, the government right now, again, as an entity, it's bloated beyond belief that
yeah.
these fools think they have to control everything. And they justify it by many means.
Well, and again, I think this is in the last few years.
Yeah,
this
the last few years,
Obama's
exactly.
Obama's FTC.
This is the culture of Washington yeah. where this is the first thing they do. Control. First thing. You know. And that's where we're heading. We're heading
I'm imagining the conversation. First of all, Zuckerberg, you're brilliant, but you're stupid.
Of course.
Because you created this great thing. And then you just gave control over it to the government because you committed misrepresentation.
Who knows? Maybe they had something on him. I don't know. Maybe they did.
What could they have
on
him?
I don't know.
I mean, they had that movie already, and it already revealed all kinds of shaky stuff about him. So what does he care? I don't care what they have on him, too. I mean, that's the other thing, right?
What I'm saying is I can't put anything past them. I just can't. These are they're bureauc rats. That's what they are.
Anyway, this train left the station long time ago. It's going to be hard to stop it. I, in my work, keep arguing that in protection of privacy, we need to go back to the rights to property and contract, because it's only by protecting privacy by our individual rights to property and contract that we can ensure that we have control to individually figure out how much privacy we want. Right? I don't want one size fits all per the federal government privacy protection.
That's a good point, Chris Gannon.
Yeah, Chris. He says it's disheartening because a guy like that could really make a difference in terms of the national dialogue.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
he has a lot of influence.
If you saw in the debates, you had Michelle Bachmann, I believe it was Michelle Bachmann, citing Steve Jobs' recommendations to Obama.
Did she?
At least one of the politicians, and I think it was her. Because remember
warned
Jobs,
Obama.
And he had complained about the fact that he couldn't find 30,000
right.
talented engineers
right.
to hire here
Literally
to build his computers,
right.
and so he had to take it to China. And so people are looking at someone like a Jobs to the extent that he's been super successful.
But he stood up to Obama, but it was also private.
But this is a sad thing too, right? I mean, yeah. He could have influence, and that's right. He probably is having influence. So people are taking this little note of his, our commitment to the Facebook community, and how he's talking about he's eager to work with the government and everything else.
And personally, I love.
And maybe they're running with it.
I love Facebook. I do. I mean, I love putting the status updates.
I hate the stacking stuff. So. You know, I mean, you promote your ideas on Facebook. You
really mean.
I publicize this show on Facebook, right? I've got the Facebook page for Don't Let It Go Unheard.
Friends based on values, based on your ideas, philosophy. I mean, this is.
It's good stuff, and I'm just sad to see it. I think that a lot of the value of it's going to go away, and I'm wondering if the reason that I sometimes find Google Plus a little bit clunky to use is because the government's already got its claws into Google in general, which means. Google Plus. I'm not sure.
Google Plus government? Is that what it's called now?
Google Plus government.
Oh, man. It's pathetic.
That's so bad. What would Facebook be, though? What would the new pun with the...
Disgracebook? I mean, I don't know. Let's see. I don't know.
By the grace of government book?
Maybe.
Something like that. I don't know. The Facebook FTC edition, right?
Oh, man.
FTC book?
Government nothing.
It's so sad. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about some good news. Bosch sent me a good news story that we can end off with today.
Very good.
As people know, the Great Britain, their embassy in, you know, the UK's embassy in Iran was raided, sacked.
Right.
And the Iranian government did almost nothing to try to protect.
Well,
I don't think they did anything.
They probably
right?
called the shots. They told them to do it. I mean, this is no joke.
So
they keep effing with us.
The government, you know, members of government in the UK have, you know, decided that the Iranian government could have done something to prevent this if it wanted to. It did not. Obviously, it was complicit in some way. And so.
I'm sorry, one second. About the puns. Sorry. Someone said gov book.
Gov book.
So
I love it.
Also,
I love
I'll
it. Gov book. FC. Now, Deb says FTC
right.
book. I think FTC
one.
Book.
How about
FTC
Two Facebook?
Two Facebook?
Yeah. Two Face. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. So I apologize. Yeah. This is a good story.
Yeah. So. Yeah, this is the sad.
Just repeat it quick. Just
FCC book people are saying.
So
let's repeat our good news story. So William Hague, who is the Foreign Secretary of the UK, he says that the UK has ordered the immediate closure of the Iranian embassy in London, and this is actually back on November 30th, a few days ago. This was following the attacks on the British embassy in Tehran. And I actually watched online the speech from William Hague. You can find it at the Telegraph's website, so the Telegraph UK, you can watch it. And it might put you in a better mood than all the stuff that I told you here today, I'm sorry to say. Anyway, so that was the one thing, that they're closing it down. And then he said that the government was also requiring the closure of the Iranian embassy in London and the departure from Britain of all of its staff,
yes.
all diplomats, within the next 48 hours.
And he got some agreements in the, you know, they were they were a little cautious.
Yeah,
they were
I think they're a little bit.
Yes, they were. But
they
understand
have decorum,
this is the right
right?
thing to do.
Yeah, they all know this is the right thing to do. So by now, actually, they should be out of there. The Iranian embassy in London closed. All of its staff, all of the diplomats ordered out of London.
Get the hell
departure
out of here.
From all of Britain. Within 48 hours, they had to leave. He said that Tehran should be ashamed of the events that took place on Tuesday, going after the British embassy. And he said that the already difficult the relations between Britain and Iran had worsened in recent weeks. And it was, of course, amid renewed concerns about Ahmadinejad's nuclear ambitions. But he says no difficulty in relations can ever excuse in any way or under any circumstances the failure to protect diplomatic staff and diplomatic premises. And the idea was that they were going for a repeat of the American hostage crisis, right? There were no Americans
they
there.
Away,
what's the next best thing?
They got away with it 30 years ago, right? Why not? Why not try it again with an even weaker country?
Foreign minister supposedly said he was sorry for what had happened. Ha. But he ordered them all out. So I thought that was wonderful. It was really good.
Who, sorry?
The Iranian foreign minister.
Why do you think? For a split second, it was like, uh-oh. They're actually showing a little backbone. Uh-oh.
Yeah, we're not going to have sanction of the victim here.
We're not
going to have Zuckerberg,
Iran is,
right?
We can wipe them off the face of the earth. They know that. But they're counting on the fact that we will never, ever, ever do it. So they're like, that's why they talk to us the way they do. So this makes them pause for a split second where the guy can actually apologize. When the hell would they ever apologize? Ever. Never. So that's good. I like that. That's a nice first step towards where we have to go.
Yes. So I like to see this. I would like to see more of this. Of course, we don't have those sort of relations with Iran anyway that we could undo and have. But
well,
I doubt that
Ron
Obama
Paul wants
would
to,
be this
wants
strong.
To offer friendship to them. Ron Paul wants to offer friendship to Iran. That's where his foreign policy goes. But anyway. That's why he could never be president.
Now, the other good news about Iran, and I can't figure out what the source of it is yet, about the various nuclear facilities explosions at nuclear facilities.
Two times within, I think, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And, of course, they're not even blaming Israel because they don't want to even give Israel credit for that. You know what I mean? Because they're so anti-Israel that we can't even give them credit if it was them. I believe it was, though. Or just their absolute incompetence. I mean, they've been trying to build a nuke for 30 years. You know, nukes have been around for, 70 years? They still can't get a nuke going. I mean, that's how behind the times they are.
So while we've got the terrible news about the Muslim Brotherhood gaining control in Egypt, we have at least Britain standing up against
Right.
Iran. And
if
we
this,
have
if this
Iran.
Is their friend.
I mean, maybe. Maybe, you know, the Iranians are incompetent with respect to the nuclear technology,
yeah.
Or maybe something else is going on that we're going to hear about pretty soon, which would be nice for somebody to actually take care of some evil in the world. So we've got to wrap up
Let
here
me
pretty
say,
soon.
If anyone wants to read the article of mine, it's on Front Page Magazine. Mm-hmm. It's called Non-Muslim Muslims and the Jihad Against the West. Check it out. It was a lot more than what I read.
And you can always check out his blog at faustin.blogspot.com. Other things to do if you like Ayn Rand, follow the Ayn Rand bot on Twitter. I've got all kinds of neat quotations going out, new ones all the time being added to the database. And also check out my blog during the week, don'tletitgo.com. I often will write up posts about stuff that we've talked about here in the show and new things during the week. So subscribing there is probably the easiest way to get in touch with me, especially given Facebook's stacking habits of late. Sometimes if
Stack
you...
Book.
Yeah, if you put a status statement that has any current news story, it's going to get lost. So my announcements about this show do. If you do enjoy the show, please also spread the word among your friends. This is a word-of-mouth enterprise, a very small business. And if you can help spread the word, we enjoy that too. If you do like the show, please tell your friends. Everybody take care, have a good evening, and we'll talk next week.
Take care.
Bye-bye.